In every pot of peppered stew, in every sizzling street corner grill, echoes a buried history. This isn't just food. This is resistance, survival, a sacred inheritance carved from slavery, migration, and memory. From African yam fields to East Indian spice routes, from colonial sugar plantations to Maroon mountain fires, Caribbean cuisine is a living archive of struggle and resilience. This is the story of flavors born in bondage and simmered into freedom. Welcome to the untold roots of Caribbean cuisine, where every ingredient has a story and every story feeds the soul. If you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform now, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Before there was callaloo or curry goat, before rice met peas or ackee met saltfish, there was hunger. The earliest chapters of Caribbean cuisine are written in chains, blood, and fire. The islands were not always filled with the smells of roasted breadfruit or the crackle of jerk smoke. When Europeans first arrived in the Caribbean in the late 15th century, they brought conquest, and with it, catastrophe. Indigenous peoples like the Taino, Kalinago, and Siboney had their own rich food systems based on cassava, sweet potatoes, maize, peppers, and wild game. They were skilled in fermentation, slow roasting, and clay pot cooking. They smoked meat over greenwood, a method they called barabecue, the root of the word barbecue. But their culinary traditions were violently disrupted, nearly erased in the fires of colonization and genocide. Then came the sugar. By the 1600s, sugarcane plantations turned the Caribbean into one of the bloodiest and most profitable economies on earth. The enslaved Africans who were dragged across the Atlantic came from dozens of culinary cultures, from the Sahel to the Congo, from Yorubaland to the Gold Coast. Each tribe, each language, each woman who remembered how to pound yam, grind okra, or smoke fish, they were forced to carry culture in their memories, not in their hands. And yet, those memories survived. In the brutal landscape of slavery, the enslaved were given the scraps: salted cod, pig tails, ox tails, chicken feet, and rice swept from barrels. But with ancestral wisdom and creativity, they turned these into soul food. They foraged wild herbs. They planted provision grounds behind the slave quarters, secret gardens of cassava, dashin, callaloo, and plantain that fed the body and spirit. Food became coded resistance. In Jamaica, Maroons built entire communities in the mountains, cooking underground to avoid detection, giving rise to the slow-smoked method of jerk. In Haiti, enslaved cooks crafted soup jumu, a spicy pumpkin soup once forbidden to them by their French masters, and later, served as a revolutionary symbol on the Day of Independence. Saltfish and ackee, Jamaica's national dish, is itself a product of tragedy and adaptation. Ackee was brought from West Africa aboard slave ships. Salted cod was shipped from the North Atlantic by European traders, often as cheap food for slaves. What began as a necessity evolved into a delicacy, a celebration of survival. Even the simple act of seasoning food became political. African cooks used scotch bonnet, thyme, pimento, garlic, and ginger not just to flavor, but to heal, to preserve, to remind. These were more than ingredients, they were links to a homeland. And while Caribbean kitchens simmered with the trauma of slavery, they also became crucibles of fusion. African techniques, indigenous roots, European tools, and later, Asian influences, all collided in the colonial kitchen. It was not harmonious, it was forced. But from the violence came something defiant, a cuisine that refused to die. The Caribbean table is, at its core, a resistance table, and it was born from starvation, memory, and revolt. This is only the beginning. By the dawn of the 18th century, the Caribbean was no longer just a string of islands. It had become the crossroads of the world. Beneath its turquoise waters and swaying palms, global empires waged invisible wars, not just for land, but for what the land could grow. Sugar was king, and behind that king stood armies, navies, and financiers from London to Lisbon, Bordeaux to Boston. But to understand how Caribbean cuisine came to be, one must first understand the brutal machinery that powered the plantations and the global arteries that fed them. The Caribbean was the beating heart of the Atlantic Triangle trade. Enslaved Africans were transported to the islands. Sugar, rum, and molasses flowed from the Caribbean to Europe. Guns, cloth, and manufactured goods made their way to Africa. Each journey fed the next, and with every turn of the wheel, new flavors, seeds, and spices entered the Caribbean. not through celebration, but through commerce and conquest. Take nutmeg, for example. Native to the Banda Islands in Indonesia, nutmeg became so valuable that the Dutch once traded the island of Manhattan to secure a monopoly over it. By the 1700s, nutmeg had found its way into Caribbean kitchens, carried on the same ships that trafficked human cargo. So too came cinnamon from Ceylon, cloves from Zanzibar, and tamarind from India. Rice, the staple of so many Caribbean plates, was not native to the islands. It was brought by enslaved Africans, not just as food, but as knowledge. West Africans from the Senegambia region were experts in rice cultivation. In fact, planters in places like South Carolina and Suriname deliberately sought slaves from rice-growing regions, knowing their agricultural skills were worth more than gold. Coconuts arrived via Portuguese and Spanish ships from the Indian Ocean. Mangoes from South Asia. Chickpeas from the Middle East. Even citrus fruits like lime and orange were colonial imports. The Caribbean was not isolated. It was global before globalization had a name. But not all newcomers arrived by European hand. After the abolition of slavery in the 19th century, plantation owners sought new sources of cheap labor. They found it in indentured servants from India, China, and even the Middle East. With them came turmeric, cumin, cardamom, dal, roti, chow mein, soy sauce, and five spice. These influences, layered atop indigenous and African culinary foundations, added new dimensions to the Caribbean palate. In Trinidad and Guyana, Indian curries adapted to local ingredients, giving birth to dishes like aloo pie, doubles, and chicken roti, beloved street foods today. In Jamaica, Chinese migrants opened small grocery shops and introduced dishes like sweet and sour chicken and lo mein, now fully Caribbean in style and flavor. Lebanese immigrants brought ziyadar, pickled vegetables, and new methods of grilling meat. It was fusion by fire, not by choice. These migrations, forced and voluntary, each left edible footprints. And while the colonizers imposed borders and flags, the people, the cooks, the mothers, the street vendors, blurred them with flavor. Yet the cost of this global exchange was staggering. For every spoon of sugar in a British teacup, there were countless backs broken in cane fields. For every barrel of molasses shipped to Boston, a slave child cried out from hunger. The sweetness of the Caribbean was bought with suffering. And still the food endured, because it had to. From the ashes of empire, the Caribbean created its own identity. One that could not be defined by the crown on a coin or the language on a passport, but by the spice on the tongue, by the stories passed in kitchens, by the hands that stir the pot, generation after generation. Food became geography. It became history. It became resistance with every bite. And the world, often unknowingly, ate it up. In the Caribbean, food is never just food. It is ritual. It is reverence. It is remembrance. Long before the rise of gourmet tourism and food festivals, the people of the Caribbean were cooking with something far deeper than flavor. They were cooking with faith. The sacred connection between food and spirituality can be traced all the way back to West Africa. Among the Yoruba, the Fon, the Igbo, and the Akan, food was a language used to speak with the gods. Offerings of yam, millet, palm oil, and kola nuts were placed at altars to communicate with orishas and ancestral spirits. When these people were forcibly uprooted and scattered across the Caribbean, they carried their beliefs not in books, but in recipes, rituals, and instinct. In Haiti, this spiritual inheritance evolved into Vodou, a religion demonized by colonizers, yet deeply rooted in African cosmology. Within Vodou, food offerings called mange lois are prepared with exacting care. These aren't symbolic gestures, they are sacred meals. Each lois, or spirit, has its preferences. Legba favors grilled corn. Ezeli loves fried plantains. Ogoun demands strong rum and red meat. These meals are placed on altars and consumed in communal ceremonies where food, drumming, and possession blur the line between the living and the divine. In Cuba and Trinidad, Lukumi, Santeria, and Shango Baptist traditions blend Catholic iconography with African ritual. A dish served to the Virgin Mary might also be an offering to Yemaya, goddess of the sea. Okra, smoked fish, and cassava cakes are cooked not just for nourishment, but for invocation. To cook is to call. The Maroons of Jamaica, descended from runaway slaves who carved free societies in the island's mountains, developed their own sacred culinary codes. Before ceremonies like Kumina or Nanny Day, whole pigs are roasted over pimento wood, cassava bami is prepared by hand, and libations are poured onto the earth. Food becomes a portal, a call to ancestors who died in rebellion or who vanished in the smoke of slavery. Even Christianity, the dominant faith of the region, could not erase the spiritual bond with food. Instead, it absorbed it. Revivalist churches hold table feasts where curry goat is prayed over and eaten with holy joy. In Catholic Caribbean communities, certain dishes are reserved for holy days: Easter bun and cheese, Christmas sorrel and ham, or fish on Good Friday. Each dish carries encoded memory, each ingredient an offering. In Rastafarian communities, food becomes a sacred philosophy. Ital cooking, derived from vital, is based on purity, balance, and respect for life. No meat, no salt, no processed additives. Just natural, plant-based meals designed to elevate the body and mind. Ital is more than a diet. It is spiritual discipline, a way to align with Jah, to feed the temple that is the body. What emerges across the Caribbean is a shared truth. The kitchen is a kind of altar. Whether it's a family kitchen in Dominica, a roadside fire pit in Grenada, or a funeral gathering in St. Lucia, food is the medium through which the Caribbean speaks to the past, honors the present, and prepares the soul for what lies ahead. Even mourning is flavored. In Wakes and Nine Nights, the dead are remembered with pots of stew, gallons of rum, and songs that stretch till sunrise. In these sacred moments, the aroma of food mixes with the breath of the ancestors, and history is not taught, but tasted. To truly understand Caribbean cuisine, you must understand this. The people do not simply eat to survive. They eat to remember. They eat to connect. They eat to rise. Walk through any Caribbean town at dawn, and you'll find them. Vendors rolling out wooden carts. Fires crackling under makeshift grills. Buckets of freshly fried fish. Bags of boiled corn. The scent of jerk smoke curling through alleyways. The clatter of cutlery on tin plates. Laughter, bartering, music. These are the sounds of survival, the rhythm of the people's kitchen. Street food in the Caribbean isn't a side note in the culinary story. It is the living heart of it. It began, like much else, in struggle. In the post-emancipation period of the 19th century, newly freed Africans had little land, few tools, and even fewer opportunities. Colonial economies were designed to keep them tethered, economically free, but socially bound. So they carved out independence wherever they could. And often that started with food. Women, especially, became the backbone of the Caribbean's informal economy. Known in Jamaica as higglers, in Barbados as mobby women, and in Trinidad as market vendors, they were the street-level entrepreneurs of their time. They sold everything from fried dumplings to tamarind balls, sugar cane juice to roast yam. Their stalls were more than markets. They were schools, confessionals, and resistance centers. Places where children were fed and culture passed hand to hand. From these humble setups, iconic dishes were born. Jamaica's jerk chicken was originally cooked by the Maroons, warriors who seasoned wild hog with pimento, buried it underground, and slow-smoked it to avoid colonial detection. By the 1900s, jerk pits lined the roadsides of Kingston and Mandeville, tended by men with secret spice rubs passed down generations. In Trinidad, doubles, that spicy, chickpea-stuffed burra bread, began as a quick fix for hungry laborers. Its creator, Mamudine Dean, sold it from a pushcart in the 1930s. Today, doubles are national treasures. In the Dominican Republic and Puerto Rico, empanadas and alcapurrias evolved from Spanish colonial pasties and indigenous frying techniques, fused with African seasoning styles. These deep-fried pockets became working-class power snacks, filling, portable, cheap. In Haiti, griot, crispy fried pork seasoned with citrus and scotch bonnet, became a street staple tied to both everyday life and celebration. Accompanied by picles, a fiery pickled slaw, it told the story of a nation that had survived slavery and revolution and now survived poverty through flavor. Street food is where class disappears, where rich and poor gather at the same stall, where no one asks for reservations. It democratizes the plate. It is also where cuisine resists erasure. Colonial powers built restaurants for the elite, French bistros in Martinique, English taverns in Barbados, Spanish cafes in Santo Domingo. But on the street, people cooked their own truth. They used local peppers, handmade sauces, and century-old techniques. In pots and pans unlicensed by the state, they preserved identity. Street food became defiance wrapped in foil, resistance on a skewer, and it was always adaptable. Migrants in the 20th century, especially from Asia and the Middle East, added new layers to the sidewalk menu. In Trinidad, Roti shops run by Indo-Caribbean families became cultural institutions. In Guyana, Chinese fried rice fused with Caribbean herbs and meats. In Suriname, Javanese satays met Dutch curry. The streets told the story better than any textbook. In every smoky roadside stall and every loud market kitchen, there is innovation, but also memory. The people's kitchen never forgets. It remembers the hunger of the plantation, the desperation of indenture, the fire of revolution, and it cooks not just to feed, but to honor. Even today, in the face of economic strain, natural disasters, and political neglect, Caribbean street food endures. Because it must. Because it is where the culture breathes. So the next time you stand before a jerk pan or a curry stand, know this. You are not just tasting food. You are tasting history. You are eating survival. In the Caribbean, food doesn't just comfort or sustain. It explodes. It dances in the street. It parades down boulevards. It sings through steel pan and bursts from boiling pots. It is carnival. It is ceremony. It is a feast that remembers both the shackles and the breaking of them. To understand Caribbean cuisine, you must enter its festivals. Carnival, one of the region's most spectacular expressions of culture, began in oppression. The French and Spanish colonizers of the 18th century brought their Catholic traditions, including pre-Lenten masquerade balls, to the Caribbean elite. These were elite, European-only events. Powdered wigs, roast goose, imported wines, and extravagant feasts held behind mansion gates. But the enslaved Africans, banned from participating, watched. And when they could, they mimicked. And when they mimicked, they transformed. What emerged from the plantations was not just imitation. It was rebellion cloaked in creativity. The enslaved threw their own festivals in secret, masking their faces, beating drums outlawed by colonial law, and preparing feasts from what little they had. Over time, these gatherings evolved into full-blown counter-celebrations. After emancipation, these secret rituals came above ground and became what we now call carnival. Carnival food is not just indulgent, it is sacred excess. It is freedom you can chew. From Palo in Trinidad, a one-pot miracle of rice, pigeon peas, chicken, and burnt sugar, to Fowlery, deep-fried chickpea fritters dipped in tamarind sauce, carnival cuisine mirrors the chaos and joy of liberation. In Haiti's carnival, you'll find marinade spiced fritters, fried pork, and mountains of rice cooked with black mushrooms, diri diadine, a dish with deep voodoo connections, often served during spiritual ceremonies. In Barbados, fish cakes sizzle alongside bottles of mabi, while in Grenada, it's oiled down, the national dish, made with breadfruit, coconut milk, turmeric, callaloo, and salted meat cooked down in one bubbling cauldron, often for entire communities. These aren't just meals, they are edible monuments, plates loaded with meaning, timing, and inherited tradition. Even colonial feasts, those of the masters, eventually left culinary imprints. The British afternoon tea rituals in Jamaica, the French sauces of Martinique and Guadeloupe, the Spanish savory stuffed pastries of Cuba, all were appropriated, reinterpreted, or subverted by the formerly colonized. Today, in Christmas celebrations, family weddings, and Sunday dinners, these influences linger, but no longer define. What once symbolized control has been absorbed, redefined, even ridiculed through Caribbean invention. Roast beef now sits beside curry goat. French crepes become coconut bakes. Colonial wine is swapped for sorrel spiced with ginger, cloves, and orange peel, served iced, red as revolt. But perhaps the most powerful symbol of this transformation is how food binds community. During carnival season, large pots appear in yards and at the backs of trucks. Aunties stir with wooden paddles, uncles shout over the radio, children dance barefoot near firewood, and everyone waits. Because the food will come. And when it does, it won't just be eaten. It will be shared. The Caribbean feast, born from slavery and shaped by colonization, has become a space of radical joy. A ritual of memory. A theater of taste. The colonizer may have brought the feast, but the Caribbean made it divine. The Caribbean was never meant to stay on the islands. It was scattered by conquest, by slavery, by choice, by necessity. The people moved. The music moved. The language moved. And the food followed. Today, from London's Brixton to Toronto's Scarborough, Brooklyn's Flatbush to Amsterdam's Bijlmer, Caribbean cuisine is everywhere. But this is not a story of trendy flavors or exotic menus. It is a story of survival. Of exile. Of cultural persistence written in spices and sauce. In the aftermath of decolonization and economic decline during the mid-20th century, hundreds of thousands of Caribbean people left their homelands. The Windrush generation sailed to Britain. Thousands more migrated to North America and Europe in search of work, dignity, and stability. They carried little, except memory. Recipes folded into old notebooks. Seasonings memorized from grandmother's kitchens. Techniques passed by word, not written down. In cold cities far from the equator, they made fire with flavor. Jamaican patty shops opened next to fish and chip stalls in East London. Trinidadian doubles stands appeared on Toronto street corners. Barbadian flying fish sandwiches showed up on Miami's boardwalks. Haitian griot and soup jumu became sacred meals in New York's Little Haiti. In every corner of the diaspora, food became homeland, but it was not always welcomed. Caribbean migrants were often met with suspicion, discrimination, and ridicule. Their food, too spicy, too greasy, too strange, was mocked. The smell of curry or fried plantains was seen as offensive by landlords. Yet, over time, it persisted. And then it took over. Today, Caribbean cuisine is not fringe. It's mainstream. It's on cooking shows, in Michelin-starred restaurants, on food trucks in Seoul, in fusion menus in Paris. But what most diners never realize is that behind every plate of jerk chicken or goat curry lies a transatlantic story of displacement and resistance. In Canada, Caribbean food has influenced national identity. Dishes like oxtail stew, roti, and jerk poutine are now found in everyday kitchens. In the UK, Caribbean takeaway is a standard part of urban food culture. In the US, Caribbean flavors have blended with soul food, Latin food, and West African food, creating new forms of culinary expression. Chefs of Caribbean descent, from Haiti's Gregory Gourdet to Jamaica's Kwame Onwuachi, are reclaiming the narrative, elevating ancestral dishes on global stages. And yet, the aunties in roadside stalls, the uncles grilling by barrel pans, the grandmothers stirring iron pots, they remain the soul of the cuisine. The diaspora did more than preserve Caribbean food, it evolved it. And in doing so, it told the world a deeper truth. That Caribbean cuisine is not just about heat or spice or fusion. It is about home. Even when that home has no flag. Even when that home was stolen. Even when that home is built from memory. Food becomes the passport. The kitchen, the embassy. The table, the nation. So when someone thousands of miles away bites into callaloo or pilau or a saltfish fritter, they are not just tasting a dish. They are tasting rebellion. They are tasting survival. They are tasting the Caribbean, unconquered, unbroken, undefeated.